You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Over the years, there have been tons of different art movements, each focusing on different aspects of our world. Lately, the trend in architecture and design has been all about minimalism, using simple, unsaturated colors like neutrals or pastels. It often feels like a way to show how serious and grown up someone is, suggesting that they don't really need bright or fun colors or strong emotions to make a statement. That's just my take, of course, but abstract art, which isn't just about Picasso or Pollock, covers a much broader category that minimalist art falls under. Abstract art aims to invoke emotions and make viewers feel something through subjective, non-representational pieces. It's such a wide umbrella that it includes artists with very different styles, from Georgia O'Keeffe and Hilma af Klint to Piet Mondrian, all of whom are classified as abstract artists, even though their approaches vary widely. O'Keeffe and Klimt are actually two artists who played a role in the Art Nouveau movement. If you're not familiar, Art Nouveau started around the late 19th and early 20th centuries and became popular across many countries, especially from the 1890s through about 1914, but even actually until the 20s. And by that point, it was competing with Art Deco. This movement was a huge deal in European culture, especially in art and literature. It had an underlying tension. People felt society was heading towards collapse or decay, and there was a lot of anxiety about the future. No idea what that's like. But at the same time, many artists and writers wanted to create something completely new, breaking away from traditional styles, what they called historicism. They believed that certain truths, morals, and logical ideas weren't stuck in the past, that some things are universally true, whether you're in ancient Rome or in modern New York. The movement aimed to bring together fine arts, design, and industry into a united whole. Its core vibe was all about a natural, plant-inspired look, with flowing lines that connected to different forms of creativity. Architecture, decorative arts, graphic design, furniture, jewelry, and more into what they called a German word, Gesamtkunstwerk, which in German means a total work of art. In this piece, I look at various sources to piece together when and where Art Nouveau started, in its influences, and even in the older styles that it sort of grew out of or could have been inspired by. I explore how the style made its way into different media, paintings, architecture, sculpture, and how different sources might tell a slightly different stories or add nuance to the history. Art Nouveau wasn't exactly the same everywhere. Its features varied depending on the country and region, shaped by local cultures and early adopters. The history of Art Nouveau varies widely depending on which country you're looking at. The name itself has an interesting origin. It first appeared in the 1880s in a Belgian journal called L'Art Moderne, where it is used to describe the works of Le Vent, a group of 20 painters and sculptors trying to push art in a new direction. The term gained popularity when a Paris-based gallery, Maison de l'Art Nouveau, opened in 1895, thanks to a Franco-German art dealer named Siegfried Bing. In Britain, people mostly stuck with the French term, but in France, they sometimes called it style moderne, which is similar to the British modern style. They also had names like Style 1900, Style Jules Verne, named after the famous novelist, or Style Metro, inspired by Hector Guimard's iconic iron and glass entrances to the Paris subway. This movement didn't exist in the vacuum. It was part of a broader scene called Art la Belle Époque, meaning the beautiful age, or Art fin de siècle, meaning art of the end of the century. These terms help describe the vibrant, innovative bursts of creativity during that time period. Throughout many ancient cultures, you can see natural elements like plants, rivers, and landscapes woven into art and architecture. These aren't just for decoration. A lot of times they had symbolic, religious, or even climate-related significance. While the sources you've shared don't point to one single unified Art Nouveau, they do show a common pattern across different cultures. Nature-inspired designs and motifs show up repeatedly as key principles in architecture and decorative art long before the Art Nouveau movement officially began. Talking thousands of years here. This gives us a historical background to better understand how later styles, especially when people look back to nature as inspiration, reinterpreted these natural forms in new and creative ways. My name is Renee. You're listening to Detours in Archaeology, the new arts of the ancient world. So for precursors, we got some ancient varieties. It wasn't only a turn-of-the-century idea, but also a fight back against modern industrialization. Whether intentional or not, the ancient past echoes through our work. In a very special way, part of Art Nouveau may have been inspired by discoveries in Egypt. Perhaps less so than the art of ancient Egypt on Art Deco in the 1920s, however, the 18th dynasty city of Amarna was partially rediscovered in 1887 when nearly 400 clay tablets known as the Amarna letters were found. These documents, dated to the 14th century BCE and constitute the royal diplomatic archive of Pharaoh Akhenaten, or Amenhotep IV, which was his name before he changed it, detailing international relations, trade, and vassal politics across the Bronze Age Near East were written in Akkadian cuneiform by local villagers in Tell El Amarna in Egypt. The biggest takeaway is that these letters are ceremonial objects, not just mail. They were sent across multiple generations of kings, housed in a records office after being brought into the new capital, and studied for years in ancient times. They represent an international style of the Late Bronze Age and were part of gift-giving, where gift-giving was a high-stakes ritual. While not particularly pertinent directly to the story of Art Nouveau, Egypt is outside the area where cuneiform writing is developed, so the Amarna letters testify to the use of the Mesopotamian script and the Akkadian language across the Eastern Mediterranean during this period. The majority of the tablets are actually letters written by rulers of the lands north of Egypt, but a few are letters from the Egyptian king, and there are also tablets inscribed with myths, epics, sibyllaries, lexical texts, and other lists, which are the kinds of texts that were used to learn cuneiform writing. But following the 1887 discovery of the tablets, significant professional excavations began under Flinders Petrie in 1891 to 1892. Further, Ludwig Bouchard's 1912 to 1913 excavation uncovered the famous Nefertiti bust. And this was all before King Tut's tomb was uncovered, filled with gilded objects and beautiful things. But while there is still ongoing work by the Egyptian Exploration Society and others at the site that continue to map the city, including the workmen's village and residential areas, we have found a great deal that gives us a fuller picture of what living in the city as a royal would have looked like. For a quick background, the site, Amarna, is located in Middle Egypt, in the 15th nome of Upper Egypt, known as the Hair Nome, or Winnet. The site was the short-lived capital city, Akhetaten, built by the quote-unquote heretical pharaoh Akhenaten, who was known as such because of his monotheistic worship of the Aten and not the other gods. Because of Akhenaten's heretical views and the new power structure, he moved the capital and took power away from the priests of Amun. He was despised and was partially removed from history, but we found him. However, this wouldn't be a complete shift in rulers, since his son, King Tutankhaten, who was later renamed Tutankhamun 3 years into his reign, so when he was around 11 years old, because he was proclaimed pharaoh at the age of either 8 or 9. The site was also abandoned around 3 years after Akhenaten's death, and Tut, well, probably his mother Nefertiti, took over as regent. This was when the capital cities reverted to Thebes, with Memphis acting as an important administrative capital, particularly during the restoration of their traditional religion after the Amarna period. The ruins of Akhenaten provide a unique, well-preserved snapshot of a specific revolutionary period in Egyptian art, religion, and history. While the site lasted, it had a completely different art style, more naturalistic, more flowing, much less rigid in the posing that had come before or had returned afterwards. You know, the quintessential walk like an Egyptian poses, which are generally wrong anyway, but I won't get into that right now. In previous articles or episodes, I have discussed how important life and nature were to the Egyptians, which is why they carved pillars to look like reed bundles, painted the tops of pillars to resemble lilies, and carved or painted natural scenes with outdoor activities into their tomb walls. It's so that they can continue to frolic in nature in their perfect afterlife for eternity. Well, Akhenaten just took it a step further. Since the one god Aten was literally the sun disk, it would have been wrong to shut it out of the temples or the homes, so architecture changed. There were still pillars with coverings, but in the center of the roof was a large hole where life and worship would take place in sun-filled spaces, featuring numerous offering tables and altars for direct, communal, and royal worship of the sun disk. The city of Akhenaten was constructed rapidly in a desert valley, relying heavily on mud brick for houses and administrative buildings, with some stone being used in important structures. To build quickly, builders used small, standardized, hand-sized stone blocks known as talatat instead of large, heavy stone blocks like you would see in other temples or in the pyramids. Architectural decoration also stylistically changed from representing traditional gods to focusing on the royal family in candid moments, such as playing with their daughters, eating, and displaying affection for each other, all beneath the Ankh, the life-giving rays of the Aten, showcasing their connection to their single god. The people were also depicted in a new exaggerated form, with a more naturalistic, yet highly stylized, often androgynous appearance, because the Aten was a single god, and therefore must represent all genders, especially in statues, since the pharaoh also had to emulate that being the Aten's earthly form. Features included long, slender limbs, elongated skulls, heavy lids, a soft, drooping stomach, and large hips. As Akhenaten believed that the Aten was the creator of all things, including nature, leading to a focus on lush, natural, and sometimes chaotic scenes that directly contradicted the surrounding desert, the decoration within palaces and temples frequently included depictions of nature, such as birds, fish, and plants, to celebrate the living world dependent on the sun disk. There were man-made gardens and ponds outside, and live plants, and even plants crafted from clay and faience for use as pottery and to decorate room interiors. Although Amarna wasn't the only site to bring the natural world into construction and decor, it was certainly a solid example of the spirit of Art Nouveau. Any coincidence? But who knows? People traveled. The art of ancient Greece is a significant influence on the appearance of Art Nouveau. I'm sure we've all seen those pieces of art with women standing or posing and wearing draped dresses and surrounded by different colors in nature. Well, that is so Grecian. The feel of this natural setting in the more innocent time of human philosophy and a connection to the world. We know this isn't how it actually was, but La Belle Époque was one of the many periods when people looked back on the past, with Greece in particular, serving as a particular point of nostalgia for people in the Western world to look back to and emulate. Examples of these were back in the 1870s. Archaeologists uncovered these tiny terracotta figures from Tanagra, a town in Boeotia. They're pretty small, about 10 to 20 centimeters tall. They were made using a mold casting method. These small statues became highly influential in art and fashion in the late 18 and early 1900s. They date back to around the late 4th century BCE, and although they were produced in many different cities, they were called the Tanagra figurines because many of them were found there, especially in the beginning. Before firing, they'd be coated with a white slip and sometimes painted with naturalistic watercolors afterwards. They didn't typically depict specific individuals, but sometimes did represent real women, as well as some men and boys dressed in everyday clothes and accessorized with items like hats, wreaths, or fans. Some figures have been inspired by characters from the new comedy plays of Menander and others, making them some of the earliest examples of fan art. Others followed an older tradition of molded terracotta figures used as religious or votive objects, or even grave offerings. People appreciated their refined appearance, and they even continued to inspire artists like Auguste Rodin. Greek Revival architecture reached its peak earlier, between the post-war of 1812 era and just before the Civil War, leaving a lasting impact on architectural history.
At least, or especially in the still new United States at the time.
Hence the White House having those Corinthian columns, and many of the Capitol buildings also having a Greek and Roman style architecture. This style was partially inspired by a desire to connect Western nations with the democracy and intellectual ideals of ancient Greece. Throughout the 19th and early 20th centuries, Western society often looked to Greece as the birthplace of civilization, influencing various aspects of culture, from fashion trends like the brief popularity of the Grecian bend posture in the 1860s to political and architectural standards. Early on, people started looking for specific motifs in art as a way to cope with their struggles. In ancient Greece, nature played a big role in art and architecture, symbolizing everything from beauty and meaning to practical and cultural values. Artists and architects often took inspiration from natural forms like flowers, leaves, waves, and earthly colors to create a sense of harmony and connection to the environment, especially with all the color on all of their beautiful statues. If you didn't know, they weren't originally white. Nature became like a symbolic language, representing ideas such as growth, fertility, calmness, harmony, and divinity. You'd see mythological stories and personifications of natural features like rivers and mountains or the sun and stars, frequently incorporated into artworks and buildings. You see them as gods, goddesses, nymphs, creatures, anything. In modern design, especially biophilic design, natural elements like plants, water features, and natural light are added to boost well-being. Sacred places and temples were often built to blend seamlessly with the landscape. Think mountains, groves, or springs, and foster a harmonious relationship with the environment. Both art and architecture often use natural materials like wood, stone, marble, bamboo, and clay because they have a way of blending seamlessly with the environment thanks to their organic textures and colors. Architects today frequently design buildings with features that mimic natural systems to save energy. Things like green roofs, solar panels, natural ventilation, and eco-friendly practices. In spiritual spaces such as groves, gardens, and springs, as well as with celestial symbols, there's a clear effort to show the divine's connection to nature. Rituals and festivals are also filled with natural elements, honoring gods of rivers, mountains, and oceans. Art, too, draws heavily on nature. Landscapes, animals, plants, and mythological creatures are extremely common, often personified or used as symbols representing ideas like beauty, life, or change. Spaces like gardens, courtyards, terraces, and water features create a smooth flow between indoors and out, making it easier to feel connected to nature. Overall, by weaving nature into art and architecture, the goal is to create spaces that look beautiful, are environmentally friendly, and have a spiritual feel, helping people feel a stronger bond with the natural world, and usually makes them happier. Comparing Greek art and the Art Nouveau movement, even though they're clearly separated by over 1,000 years, these two movements both share this awesome idea called organic idealism. Basically, they look at nature not just to copy it, but to find some kind of hidden rhythm and symbolic language tucked away in natural forms. Makes me think of the golden ratio in shells and flowers and like even photographs that people are trying to take today. The early Greek artists used what Emmanuel Loewy called memory images, kind of like stylized mental snapshots of natural shapes that they used to create their art. Later, the Art Nouveau artists did something similar. They took the flowing, curving shapes of vines and stems, those elegant, almost whip-like curves, and transformed them into lively, fluid designs that felt both natural and artistic. A almost literal link was the acanthus leaf. Now, the acanthus leaf is probably the most recognizable symbol in classical motifs. It first appeared in Greece during the 5th century BCE, especially on Corinthian columns. And over time, it became a key element in Western decorative arts. Later, during the Art Nouveau period, artists like Hector Grimard and William Norris drew inspiration from this Greek design. But they didn't just copy it, they played with it, stretching and twisting the leaf's jagged edges to match the flowing asymmetrical style that was popular in the late 19th century. And there was more stylization over literalism at this point. Neither movement really aimed for the perfect photographic accuracy. Instead, they both embraced a more stylized form of naturalism. So think of Impressionists. For example, early Greek artists simplified nature into its most recognizable features, like the profile of a bird or the symmetrical shape of a leaf, to tell a clear visual story. Similarly, Art Nouveau artists took floral forms such as irises, lilies, and poppies and exaggerated them into the flowing elongated lines that highlighted the energy and movement of growth rather than aiming for an exact realistic depiction. Both movements were all about mastering the line as a key element, using it to add both decorative flair and structural support. In Greek vase painting, the black figure and red figure styles used smooth flowing lines to outline human figures and the floral patterns called palmettes that frame them beautifully. Think of Hercules. They use the same kind of line drawing in that animated movie. Moving to Art Nouveau, things got even more expressive with the famous whiplash curve, an elegant, organic line that mimicked the graceful arc of a swan's neck or a gentle ripple of water. These curves appeared everywhere, especially in decorative borders on Greek pottery, but in Art Nouveau, they took center stage, emphasizing fluidity and movement in a very natural, almost effortless way. In many cases, nature wasn't just a neutral backdrop for either group. It actually held deep symbolic significance. For example, in Greek art, nature was often used to symbolize the divine or represent the cycle of life and death. A good example is the pomegranate, which Persephone holds as a sign of the underworld and renewal. Moving to the Art Nouveau period, artists frequently depicted the changing seasons and insects like dragonflies to symbolize transformation and the fleeting nature of life. These themes of change and transient beauty were also common in Greek funerary art, reflecting a shared fascination with life's impermanence. As an example I gave before, in Greek pottery, you'll often see this decorative motif called the palmette. As I didn't really describe it earlier, it's kind of like a fan shape and shows up as a part of rhythmic borders on pottery. When the Art Nouveau movement came around, they took that simple rigid fan design and gave it a new twist. Instead of keeping it stiff and formal, they made it look as if it was melting or flowing into organic vine-like shapes, giving the motif much more fluidity and a natural feel. Another one that I mentioned was the acanthus leaf, which is probably one of the most recognizable connection we actually have. For the Greek, it was used pretty prominently on the tops of the Corinthian columns, giving a fancy, detailed look to their architecture. Later on, artists during the Art Nouveau movement took a different approach, seeing it as a wild, almost rebellious plant. They turned it into a decorative element that seems to come alive, wrapping around furniture or climbing up walls, giving the sense of nature breaking free from its traditional forms. Kind of reminds me of extra flowers around one of those line spiral things that you put under your name or under a word when you want a title to look fancy. But both styles use lines to suggest movement. Greek vase painters often use smooth black or red lines to outline the human figure and decorate it with floral patterns. Both Greek and Art Nouveau styles play with nature by creating repeating patterns, like decorative friezes you'll see in Greek architecture, or the elaborate wallpaper designs in Art Nouveau houses. Neither style tries to copy nature in exactly as it is. Instead, they idealize it, transforming flowers and plants into versions that fit with their aesthetic rhythm and harmony. You can see how they blend function with beauty, and Greeks incorporated floral motifs into the structure of their buildings, such as columns, making the design feel integrated and cohesive. Similarly, Art Nouveau architects like Victor Horta took iron supports and designed them to resemble growing stalks or vines, giving the whole building a lively organic feel. Many of the specific motifs from ancient Greek art and architecture remain influential today because they invoke a sense of timelessness, order, though a little bit of chaos, but still authority, showing how these styles continue to inspire modern design. Ancient Greek designs are often pretty common in today's government buildings, museums, and memorials. You can spot their influence in the column designs, Doric, which is simple and sturdy, Ionic, with its signature scroll-like volutes, and Corinthian, known for the elaborate acanthus leaf decorations. The triangular pediments and horizontal friezes are also still used around doorways and rooftops, often decorated with modern sculptures. The acanthus leaves now appear in decorative moldings, ceiling rosettes, and even on furniture. Another classic touch is the egg and dart pattern, a repeating design of oval and arrow-like shapes that you often find on cornices and crown moldings, giving buildings a timeless and refined look. As I've already discussed, Greek pottery often featured motifs that acted like visual punctuation, helping to frame scenes and establish a sense of rhythm. One common pattern is the Greek key, or meander, which is a continuous line that folds back in on itself, symbolizing unity and infinity. The design is still popular today, showing up in fashion, branding, like the famous Versace logo, and interior textiles. Another familiar motif is the palmette and the enthymion, which are both stylized fan-shaped leaves often paired with lotus flowers arranged in a chain. These designs are frequently seen in modern wallpaper, tiles, and jewelry. And then there are waves, simple rhythmic curves that represent the sea, widely used in contemporary bathroom tiling and nautical-themed decor. All of these motifs reflect the rich symbolism and artistic style of ancient Greece, but they continue to inspire design in our everyday life. And sculpture. While these aren't patterns in the strictest sense, certain sculptural motifs really shape how we see the Western human form. For example, the idealized human figure. Think of sculptures like the Venus de Milo or the Tanagra figurines. They have long influenced art and even fashion photography, especially when it comes to perfect proportions and balance. Then there's the drapery style, particularly the famous wet drapery look, where the stone seems almost like a flowing fabric. This motif has been reimagined in modern high fashion designs and is reminiscent of the artistic clothing as seen in Mucha's Art Nouveau paintings. Additionally, mythological figures, gods, heroes, such as Achilles, Athena, Hermes, are often adapted into modern logos, movies, musicals, and digital art, showing how these ancient motifs still resonate today. With all this discussion about Greece, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Rome. The reason I'm not diving deeper into the Eternal City is that although many motifs are similar, there are stylistic differences. Rome and Greece approached nature differently in their art and architecture. Greeks emphasized harmony by building structures like the theaters into natural hillsides to blend with the landscape, while Romans used advanced engineering and artificial foundations to dominate and control their environment. I'm not necessarily saying that either one is right and either one is wrong. They're just different styles. But as a result, Roman architecture focused more on grandeur, urban spectacle, and innovation rather than direct environmental harmony. And that might just be looking back at Greece with rose-colored glasses as well. Looking through it with a more modern art style lens, Greece seems more like Art Nouveau, while Rome resembles more Art Deco, which is shown in a lot of movies and other pieces of media today. In the book Manuscripts, Codices, Texts, Science, and Medicine, in Papathemasios' chapter, it suggests that art isn't just decoration, but actually the oldest and most powerful way humans react spiritually to the physical world. It points out the desire to create art is a fundamental part of how our spirit tries to make sense of our environment. Basically,
she argues,
humans aren't just making art out of nowhere. They're responding to signals in nature that their senses pick up. So art becomes a kind of back and forth with nature. Nature sends a message, and the artist interprets it. By using this text, I'm not trying to say that she is definitively correct, but I tend to agree with the intrinsic quality of wanting to understand nature, especially because that's what the sciences are, and that includes math and physics. You're trying to understand something in nature, even if it's not a plant or a animal. It's still part of the world and part of life. The author is looking into whether art acts as a kind of special code or language that connects people in the natural world. She suggests that through art, humans try to reveal the hidden secrets of nature, those laws that control everything in the universe, big and small. She also wonders if nature has some kind of built-in wisdom to plan, and if art is how humans interpret and share that wisdom. One interesting point in the text is how incorporating nature into art actually changed humans both physically and mentally. The book states that art has helped train our brains into achieving higher levels of creativity later on. Additionally, in trying to accurately or symbolically depict the natural world, humans develop the mental frameworks needed for complex fields like geometry. Observing natural patterns or motifs came first and directly contributed to mathematical achievements. Still looking at you, golden ratio. The text explores the human nature relationship between a theater metaphor, showing how art helps us make sense of it all. It describes nature as a big, ongoing show of life, with birth and death happening in a continuous cycle. Humans are like actors in this grand theater, and we use art to understand our place in the bigger picture. Creative expression becomes our tool for exploring and finding meaning as we evolve alongside Earth's biological and physical changes. While this philosophical book is all about the why, the rest of the book, which explores botany and old manuscripts, shows the how. In the past, turning nature into art meant creating botanical illustrations for medicine. These manuscripts didn't just look attractive, they featured nature motifs that helped identify medicinal plants. Essentially, the art was for more than decoration. It was a practical way to track natural remedies and ensure scientific knowledge continued to advance. And of course, all of this knowledge existed long before there was writing, or even particular works of art that we have identified. You can even just look at the caves in France that have all the bulls and all the deer and everything in them. They were shown, this is what we hunt. More symbolic, but still, it works. Using nature as a canvas, humanity has always been fascinated by nature and has tried to understand it in many ways. According to the same chapter by Papathasio, she also discusses how people have historically used art, careful observation, and scientific records to connect with and learn from the natural world. The main idea of the entire book is that ancient medicine and science aren't just old, static things. They're living traditions that have evolved along with us and are closely linked to how our minds have grown. Since the very beginning of art, humans have looked at nature not just to copy it, but to interpret it and incorporate it into our creative expression, whether through cave paintings or modern digital art. Nature has always been an open canvas, a subject to explore, and even a material for art. As a subject matter, nature is most directly shown in art when it's the main focus. For example, landscape painting has gone from those dreamy, idealized scenes of the 17th century to wild, powerful views that the romantic artists like J.M.W. Turner loved to capture, bringing out the awe and the grandeur of the outdoors. Artists also like to study plants and animals closely, treating them as subjects worth both scientific study and beautiful art. Think of Leonardo da Vinci's detailed sketches of flowers and creatures, or Georgia O'Keeffe's large close-up floral paintings, which also look like pieces of human anatomy. Clear examples of how nature has inspired art for centuries. Instead of showing nature exactly how it is, a lot of art and design movements take inspiration from its underlying geometry, patterns, and organic shapes. For our topic, Art Nouveau, embracing the flowing, sinuous curve seen in flowers, vines, and insects, using these to design furniture, buildings, and other decorative objects. Modern design often copies how nature solves problems, like the strength of a bird's neck or the smooth aerodynamic shape of bird wings to tackle complex engineering and architectural challenges. For a specific example, the whale fin design of wind turbines to make it go through the air more efficiently and create more energy. And yet, even seeing the math of it I still have yet to see it actually used anywhere, which is disappointing. Many artistic traditions, such as the Islamic mosaic art or the use of the Fibonacci sequence in paintings, also rely on the perfect mathematical patterns found in nature's growth, emphasizing the inherent harmony and structure. I mean, you've also seen, like, dragonfly wings with all the little pieces. Sure looks like some of the Art Nouveau windows that are still being made today. As I brought up in a different context, some artists take things a step further than just depicting nature. They actually use natural materials as their art. For example, land art or earth art involves artists like Andy Goldsworthy, who create temporary site-specific pieces using only what they find right there. Stones, ice, leaves, soil. And these pieces often blend back into the environment over time, emphasizing how life and art are fleeting. Similarly, the materials in art have roots in nature. From ancient times when Paleolithic artists painted caves with iron oxide and charcoal, to today's artists working with berries, clay, or plants to create dyes. Basically, nature isn't just as a subject for art, it's the very stuff of the art itself. Nature is like a visual language that shows us complicated human feelings or deep philosophical ideas. In many cultures, certain plants and animals have special symbolic meanings. For example, in Asian art, the four gentlemen, which include the plum blossom, orchid, bamboo, and chrysanthemum, stand for the seasons and qualities such as purity, resilience, and elegance. Artists often use nature to reflect our own lives, showing a storm to represent inner chaos, or a garden to potentially symbolize renewal and personal growth. Some artists take a pretty chill approach by letting nature do the creating itself. They might set up a canvas outside in the wind so that the weather pattern ends up shaping the paint strokes, or even attach drawing tools to trees so their natural sway can draw on paper. They turn nature from just a subject into a partner in the artistic process, letting it influence and create art in its own way. Whether it's a painter closely observing nature with a scientific eye to capture its details, or a land artist quickly arranging stones in a spontaneous temporary display, including nature in art helps us feel more connected to the world around us. It's like a bridge that links our emotions and perceptions with the environment we live in, shaping how we interpret and engage with the natural world through various creative expressions. Throughout history, nature has consistently inspired artists, whether they're painting landscapes, animals, or plants to capture its beauty, especially without destroying it. They use the vivid colors of flowers and the soft pastels of sunsets to set moods and invoke feelings, while the shapes and forms, like the gentle curves of a flower or rugged lines of a mountain, add interesting design elements. Light plays a big role too, bringing scenes to life with shadows and depth as it interacts with water, leaves, or clouds. Plus, nature often symbolizes themes like growth, renewal, or spirituality, and the artists incorporate those natural materials that they can find, like wood, stone, or clay, to add texture and authenticity to their work. All these elements, colors, shapes, symbols, and materials have fueled artistic creativity throughout history, making nature an endless source of inspiration. Now turning to a completely different source of inspiration for Art Nouveau, Japan. Japan's influence on European art around the turn of the 20th century is pretty well known, especially through the rise of Japonisme, which helped shape styles like Art Nouveau and Jugendstil. You can see this influence all over the place, whether in painting, graphic design, ceramics, fashion, or other decorative arts, mainly through Japanese visual elements such as ukiyo-e prints, natural motifs, asymmetric layouts, and fresh takes on space and ornamentation.
ukiyo-e, which translates to something like pictures of the floating world, is a genre of Japanese art from the 17th to 19th centuries, featuring woodblock prints and paintings that captured everyday life, entertainment districts, kabuki actors, and landscapes. These vibrant, often mass-produced images mostly date to the Edo period, from 1615 to 1867, and reflect the leisurely activities of a growing urban crowd. The ideas and aesthetics from ukiyo-e played a big role in reshaping European modernity. Like I said, Japan's influence on Art Nouveau largely stemmed from Japonisme, a movement
that first took root
in France and spread across Europe. It played a major role in shaping modern design across various media, like painting, posters, ceramics, and architecture. Philip Birdy's term, Japonisme, really helped clarify how Japanese aesthetics made their way into Western art, including styles like Art Nouveau and others. This influence peaked in the late 1800s and continued to shape the decorative arts well into the early 1900s. Key elements such as the ukiyo-e prints and traditional Japanese design ideas contributed to the ornamental, flat, and stylized natural motifs that were so characteristic of Art Nouveau. These influences can be seen in poster art, book illustrations, and decorative objects from that period.
Follow the read-along link to see examples.
The cross-cultural exchange mainly occurred through expositions, galleries, and collectors, and Samuel Bing's Paris-based art venue, as well as the broader trade and travel routes that connected Europe to Japan after the Meiji Restoration. This interaction was often viewed as a two-way street, with European artists borrowing Japanese motifs and reinterpreting them through a modern
and Eurocentric
lens. Modern scholars point out that Japonisme and its later version Neo-Japonisme were deeply rooted in political and cultural stories, such as expositions, government-curated shows, and national branding efforts that aim to present Japan's modernity as both visually appealing, philosophically unique. These narratives influence how Art Nouveau was understood and appreciated across different countries. Some scholars debate how exactly this influence worked, while a few see Japan's influence on Europe as still pretty straightforward and one way. Others believe the exchange was more complicated, with both sides influencing each other. For instance, European art styles, especially groups like MAVO, MAVO, and Action during the Meijing era, also played a role in shaping Japanese artists. Plus, the idea that Japonisme is just a fixed single thing is actually debated too. Instead, many see it as a lively, evolving process, with different artists and groups adopting, reinterpreting, and even critiquing it in various ways. Which makes a lot more sense if it lasted for decades. In the realm of ceramics, glass, and decorative arts, Japanese motifs merge with Art Nouveau forms and techniques. Regional practitioners, especially in Alsace, integrated Japonisme sensibilities into their ceramics, evident in the motifs and glazes that align with Art Nouveau aesthetics. The Alsace region, including Saint-Léonard-en-Thiers, is a notable hub where Art Nouveau, Jungstil, and Japonisme converged, producing works that blend Japanese decorative elements with broader European styles. Fashion and portraiture also reveal this cross-cultural influence. Japanese textiles and kimono aesthetics appeared in European clothing styles, as reflected in the late 19th century paintings. Research shows how Japanese fashion imagery entered European visual culture and became a motif in portraiture, enhancing Art Nouveau's fascination with exotic ornamentation. In architecture and urban designs, Japanese vegetal and flowing forms contributed to the naturalistic style of Art Nouveau. Discussions about how Japonisme influenced the depiction of nature in architecture, from facade ornamentations to interior decor, with Japanese graphic art serving as a key inspiration for wave-like inorganic forms. Several important works show how Japanese influence spread during that time. For example, posters and graphic designs inspired by ukiyo-e, such as the tsunami wave picture, especially inspired Belgian and French posters that feature Japanese-influenced layouts and symbols within the Art Nouveau style. In ceramics and decorative arts, objects blending arts and crafts with Art Nouveau often incorporate Japanese designs and techniques produced in European workshops, such as the one that I mentioned earlier of Saint Leonard and other Sanshin studios. But this is not to say that Japan played all of the influence on Art Nouveau. This is just one of the many cultures that got involved with it, as people tend to get involved with nature. But we can see how the framing of where things came from can change depending on where you are in the world. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Detours in Archaeology.
Le Chant Art Nouveau, or The New Arts of the Ancient World.
It would be amazing if anyone listening could subscribe to my podcast, to like this episode and all other episodes that they listen to, to rate and review it, and to share it with everyone you know. That is the way to get my podcast to different ears, and I really want to expand this and grow this into a whole community.
Leave a comment. Head over to the website to read about and follow along with the text of this document. See all the beautiful images that I included with it and the references at the end for all my citations.
I really appreciate your undoubted patience with my
lack of being able to pronounce things.
I only really speak English, and I am trying to get pronunciations correct, and I'm sorry that I know that I messed up. I hope it wasn't too grating on your ears.
I did start a Discord for Detours in Archaeology. I hope you join so we can talk about stuff and what I should do next.
I have a store on Printify. I'm also in the process of making a lot of different bone art, and I want to deal more with getting that out there to the public. If you have any comments, corrections, or questions, I encourage you to email me at detoursinarchaeology@gmail.com. You can comment directly on this podcast. You can go to my website at detoursinarchaeology.com and hit the contact button to contact me that way. Or you can follow me on any of my Blue Sky account or my Instagram.
All the music comes from Scott Buckley, who can be found at scottbuckley.com.au.
The fun fact this week is also about nature, because it's, you know, spring and it's gorgeous and I love it. This fact is from interestingfacts.com, written by Michael Nordine. But when you're sitting outside hearing the wind through the trees, just remember that a howling wind can make it seem as though the air itself is roaring across the landscape. But what we hear on a windy day isn't the moving air itself. It's the way that the air interacts with the environment. And the different sounds that we associate with wind depend on exactly what the air encounters along the way. Sound is produced when vibrations travel through a medium, such as air, to reach our ears. Wind by itself is simply air that flows from areas of high pressure to low pressure. Smooth air moving uniformly doesn't vibrate in a way that produces sound waves that our ears can detect. So in a perfectly unobstructed conditions, the wind could move past you without making any audible noise at all. Familiar sounds we associate with wind come from friction, as moving air collides with buildings, rustles trees, squeezes through cracks, or rushes past uneven surfaces. It creates tiny pressure changes and vibrations. Those disturbances generate sound waves, which is why wind can whistle through a narrow opening or roar through a forest canopy. The faster and more chaotic the airflow becomes, the louder those interactions tend to be. That's also why different environments give wind different, quote-unquote, voices. A city full of buildings produces whistles and echoes, forests produce rustling and rushing sounds, and open plains may almost seem silent even when the air is moving quickly. So I'd say get outside, whether it's a particularly windy day or not, and just listen to the sounds, breathe in the air, and just enjoy being outside, wherever you are.
This is the first part of two, and the second will focus on the version found in Portugal and the chronology and geography of the history of the Art Nouveau movement and where it spread.
Until then, stay curious, stay inspired, and keep taking those detours. Thanks.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.